Never. Never.
How come she's so fat?
Milton, looking to his daughter seated front and center, staring at him with resigned eyes, then back at the kid who asked the question. How come you're so ugly?
Is her mommy really dead?
Yes.
How did she die?
Hello? This to the head-down half-a-nun in the rear of the room. What are you doing back there, smoking crack? That's not a nice question, Anthony, she said, still not looking up.
What's your favorite team?
The Red Sox.
Boo! Do you like Big Poppy?
I am Big Poppy. And again,
did you ever kill anybody?
I said no, too, but they had it coming. 3. And now this here, the Daughters of Jacob Assisted Living Center. The air redolent of boiled hot dogs and Lysol, Mantovani strings drifting through the halls like musical hall doll, old folks sitting alone in the lobby just staring at air, filling him with anger at their AWOL kids. Before he could even make his way to the elevator banks, and not for the first time, one old lady, confusing him with some Jose from building services, asked him when he was coming to fix her radiator. His Aunt Pauline had her own small suite, at least he had been able to swing that for her, and as she went on and on about a gluey Hawaiian salad she had been served the week before, he sat on her living room couch and took in the art on display. A bowl of silver and gold papier-mâché fruit, a plaster pair of life-size praying hands, 2, count 'em, 2 ceramic menorahs, a glazed and mounted ram's horn, and a framed print of a fiddler floating sideways above an off-balance ghetto. Aunt, excuse Tant, Pauline, had stayed in the faith, if only sentimentally, unlike her sister, Milton's mother, who married a PR to spite her parents. On the other hand, his father had married his mother to spite her parents, too. It was a match made in hell, and if his old man's this-time-for-good disappearance when Milton was 10 was not exactly a cause for celebration, it wasn't nearly enough of a blow to throw anyone off their feet.
"So you didn't bring Sophie?" Pauline asked.
"Sophia. She has school. I'll bring her on the weekend." Seated across from him on an oversized throne chair, her hands clasped atop her kettle drum midriff, his aunt tracked his gaze to the framed photos of his and her dead family members, the images scattered across the side tables and windowsills.
"I talk to them all the time," she said.
"Me too."
"In the middle of the night, sometimes, I wake up and see my sister standing in a corner of the room."
"I see all of them."
"Your brother was such a sweetheart."
"Which one?" Although he knew. Little man had been everybody's favorite.
"That day killed your mother."
"Killed my other brother, too."
"Who, Edgar?"
"Yes," he said slowly. "Your oldest nephew."
"Edgar was always so surly."
Milton stood up, took a little walk around the coffee table to settle himself. "He took care of us, Aunt Pauline. My mom with her circulation, half the time she couldn't even make it out of the house."
"You were pretty surly back then, too. The both of you, but look at you now, a real man who doesn't forget his family."
"Family's everything."
"I can't even get my own children to visit me, but you come by like clockwork."
Of course he did. Pauline had taken him in for 3 years, right after the slow-motion massacre had come to an end, the move from the Bronx to her home in Brooklyn most likely saving his life. He drew a breath before shifting gears. "Aunt Pauline, when you would come and visit us back then, do you remember a girl in our building, Carmen? Puerto Rican, about 15 years old?"
"Carmen?"
"Maybe spend time with little... with Rudy?"
"Carmen."
"Skinny. Big eyes. Long hair."
"Wait, Carmen. From downstairs, her mother was Dolores."
"Right. Did you ever see her with Rudy?"
"Dolores?"
"Carmen."
"What, like, together?"
"Like anything, holding hands, making out, arguing maybe."
"Dolores had a son too, Willie? William?"
"Victor. But let's stick with Carmen."
"He was supposed to be a little, you know, that way, the boy. Not that it bothered me."
"Aunt Pauline," Milton said, waving his hand. "Carmen, did you ever see her with Rudy?"
"I can't remember."
"Think hard."
"I wish I could."
"No problem." It was a long shot anyhow.
Why are you asking about Carmen all of a sudden?
Nothing,
Milton shrugged, trying to keep his voice as casual as he could.
I thought I maybe saw her. It was probably somebody else.
But was it really her? Oh yeah, you bet. How could he ever forget those tea-stained big eyes, pulled down sad at the corners like the eyes of the lost and burning girls on the Anima Sola postcards that used to turn him on when he was a kid? He'd even had a crush on her for a hot minute when her family had first moved into the building, a sense memory so galling and torturous to him now that it made him want to rip out his brain. He glanced at the sunburst clock over Pauline's head. 2:30, tea time. He went to the refrigerator and poured her a brimming glass from the half-gallon of Gallo Family Zinfandel she kept in there.
74 years old, I'm finally an alky, she said,
her standard line whenever he did the honors. You'll live.
Why did you and your brothers always call Rudy Little Man?
Because everybody else in the family topped out at 5'8". Then Rudy gets born, and he's all of a sudden 6'3".
I don't get it.
His eyes turned dull as nickels.
Whatever happened to Dolores?
Pauline asked. I heard she got cancer, Milton said. About 2 years after the... After the what? Tragedy? He hated that word. It reeked of... What? Fate? Inevitability? Bullshit. Tears and a turn for home? Fuck you. Surrender to the mysteriousness of the great Mysterian? Surrender. What can you do? Plenty.
And they never found those bastards who killed him, she said.
No, they didn't, Tante Pauline. Milton rising, this time to leave. And they never will. Chapter 4. By the time Billy arrived at the scene of a double shooting on the Lower East Side, directly across the street from the Alfred E. Smith houses, both victims, conscious and looking more pissed than traumatized, were being gurneyed into separate ambos as a mixed crowd of club kids and born-heres took snaps with their iPhones. Anybody looking to go out of the picture? He asked Stupak.
Doubt it. They were both howling pretty good before you got here.
Anything on the shooter?
You're looking at them, Mayo said.
Which?
Both.
Yeah?
It looks like they were walking from opposite ends of Oliver, Stupak said, and decided to jack each other at the same time. It's all on camera and we recovered the guns.
Spy versus spy, except they're both black, Mayo said. Then, having filled his word quota for the night, stepping to the corner for a smoke.
So my question to you, boss, Stupak said, are they perps or victims?
Billy thought about it a moment. They're perptims.
Do you think this is funny?
A young Hispanic woman snapped, her eyes shimmering with anger.
Hey, how you doing? Do you know any of these guys?
Stupak asked easily, making her disappear into the Smiths.
Can you bring her back here, please?
She asked the uniform. Billy's cell thrummed inside his sport jacket, a fresh text from Stacy. Can you please answer my calls, please? That's the only way to get me to stop. He knew her enough to know that this was true, and it was time to get it over with. To brace himself, he went into an all-night bodega and came out chugging a turbo tea. Hey, it's me.
Jesus, he lives.
Sorry, my phone's been don't. Was it the energy drink that made the cigarette taste so good or the other way around? So what's up, you okay? As usual, after building up a case against returning Stacy's calls, now that he was actually talking to her, he couldn't remember what the big deal was.
Yeah, but I need to tell you something, she said.
What's that?
Have breakfast with me. It's a long story.
Give me the headline.
Just have breakfast with me.
Stacy, you'll be glad you did. Well, maybe glad isn't the right word. That right there was the big deal. 5 hours later, Billy sat in his parked car outside the tin can of a diner in Mount Vernon where he was to break bread with Stacy Taylor. He smoked one cigarette, then another, delaying as long as possible the sit-down to come. Seeing her was always a wrenching experience, the psychic equivalent of returning to a battlefield with your former enemy, years after the bloodbath that had scarred you both, eager to reach out but unable to rid yourself of the lingering acid that still bit at the back of the throat. In 1997, Stacy had been a young reporter for the New York Post, an aggressive up-and-comer who glommed onto Billy's notorious double-shooting in the Bronx, attempting to make her journalistic bones by investigating the rumor that he'd been high when he pulled the trigger. Backed by two independent eyewitnesses, both willing to go public, both claiming to have seen him doing blow in the rear of an Intervale Avenue bar an hour before the shooting, as well as two more witnesses who wouldn't go on record, but corroborated the statements of the two who would, Stacy went in and made a hard pitch to her editors, touting the thoroughness of her background checks on her sources, then bombarding them with reports about police abuse in the area, anecdotal evidence that was as easy for her to gather out on the street as picking daisies. In the end, she needn't have tried so hard. 1 week earlier, the Post had lost out to the Daily News on the suicide of a retired police lieutenant in a Queens dope motel, and her editors were hot to get back on top. The story was page one for 2 days running, so when it all fell apart shortly after, everyone involved got scorched, but no one as badly as Stacy. In the end, it came down to those background checks. In her anxiety about losing her scoop to the time-sucking demands of a thorough vetting of her sources, she hadn't done them at all. The real background checks, conducted embarrassingly enough by the Daily News, revealed that one of the on-record eyewits was the brother of a heroin dealer Billy had sent upstate, while the other had twice before borne false witness against cops as payback for his own slew of arrests in that precinct. As for the two others who would only talk off the record, no one had seen them since the article hit the stands. With Stacy caught flat-footed in her lie and with no hard evidence to back up her account, the story was quickly buried, although never retracted. Within the week she was out the door, the story behind her story having become its own newsworthy story, the subject of self-examining op-ed pieces across the country and not a few panel discussions. Excoriated for unhesitatingly scuttling a good cop's reputation to further her own, emotionally whittled to a nub by her disgrace, and unable to support herself even if she chose to make a stand, Stacy moved back in with her parents in Rochester. With her father's help, she became a part owner of a food truck christened My Hero, which was more or less permanently stationed across the street from the SUNY Brockport dormitory complex. After 2 years of full-time sandwich-making in this drizzly exile, she endured another blow when both her parents died in a collision with an ambulance at an intersection 3 blocks from home. She spent the first 2 weeks after the funeral living alone in their house, hoping for a visitation, then put it on the market. A few months later, temporarily flush with the proceeds of the sale, a small inheritance, and the buyout money she received from selling her share of My Hero, she quietly returned to the city. Unable to find work as a reporter, but banking on the skills she had developed as one, she reinvented herself as a private investigator, earning just enough to take a lease on a one-bedroom walk-up near Columbia University. For a while, she held on to the hope of finding her way back into the newspaper business, but that pipe dream came to an end the day she accepted an invitation to address an ethics and ambition seminar in the university's J School, the experience leaving her feeling like a still sentient cadaver picked over by medical students in an anatomy class. Rather than enjoying the poetic justice of Stacy's downfall, Billy felt torn. No, actually sorry for her, mostly ignoring the fact that she had tried to advance her career on his broken back. In fact, he had been the one to make the first move, reaching out to her with an email a year after she returned to the city, and since then they had gradually, cautiously become friends. For her part, Stacy had been both astonished and humbled by his lack of vindictiveness, never once imagining that his gentle overture was motivated by anything other than old-time Christian compassion. When Billy finally got it up to enter the diner, he spotted her at once, sitting at a booth in the back, north of 40 now, too thin, too much wine, too much late-night TV, paradiddling an unlit cigarette against the formica and reading the paper that had shit-canned her 18 years ago for getting it all wrong about Billy and the shooting. She was wearing a ribbed turtleneck that made her look even bonier than she was and accentuated her slightly scoliotic posture. her hair, a blonde so ashy that it was impossible to tell how gray it might be turning, was pulled back in a short rubber band-bound ponytail, and her watchful eyes were, as always, a little too quick, as if she were jonesing for something she couldn't have. She'd been a golden girl once, and she took her tumble hard. "Hey, how's it going?" Billy said as he took a seat.
"The meat's so tough that it got up off the plate and beat the shit out of the coffee, which was too weak to defend itself."
"No kidding."
"The PI business sucks. I hate the people who hire me, and I hate the people they want found."
"I hear you."
"Never serve a subpoena on a guy holding a pan of bacon. I put up my arm to protect my face and ruined a perfectly good North Face coat."
"Good thing it was a cold day," he said mildly. Then, wanting her to get to it, "So,
I'm back to writing."
"For money?"
"Not much, but you bet."
"Good for you. This could take a while."
"I'm writing an online sex column."
"A what?"
"For this e-zine, Matterhorn."
"What's an e-zine?"
"Don't worry about it. My nom de plume is Lance Driver."
"A guy?"
"A guy advising other guys."
"Wow, that's..."
"Yesterday, I advised some moke that if your girlfriend wants to stick a finger up your ass, it doesn't mean she thinks you're a fag."
"No?"
"It means she's curious. She wants to know your body."
"Okay," Billy said. "How far up?"
Stacy finally lit her cigarette, took a quick drag, and then put it out before they could arrest her. "I draw the line at the first knuckle."
"Okay," shifting in his seat. "So what did you want to talk to me about?"
"I have a new boyfriend."
"Oh, yeah?"
"I'm 45 and I have a boyfriend. He's 57 and he has a girlfriend. I mean, what the fuck, right?"
Whatever it was she had to share was making her very nervous, although calling Stacy nervous was like calling water wet. When she was in a state like this, it was cruel to rush her. "The boyfriend, what's he do?"
"He edits Matterhorn."
"He's good to you?
That's a very considerate question."
"Yes? No?" Stacy looked off.
"He's no stranger to the vine."
"How much?"
2 bottles, maybe a little more. He's a sweet drunk, but it's like talking to a small child towards the end of the evening."
"Did you try AA?"
"I can't even get him to AAA.
"He'll lose you."
"He'll die is what he'll do."
"Threaten to walk out."
"I don't want to."
"Threaten?"
"Walk out. I haven't had a boyfriend in 8 years. I like caring about what I look like again. I like being spooned."
"Sounds like a problem there, Stace." The waiter finally came over, the guy sporting a reddish-gray comb-over and an apron up to his sternum.
"Try the grape jelly omelet," Stacy coughed. "It's excellent."
"Just coffee." Then turning back to her. "Not that I don't enjoy seeing you, but why am I here?"
"Are you ready for this?"
Billy waited.
"You remember Memory Williams had this twin sister?"
"Shakira, right?" Billy took one of Stacy's cigarettes. This couldn't be good.
"Shakira Barker. How twins can have different last names, I'll never understand."
Billy envisioned that couch in the living room again. Memory's head in Tanya Howard's lap. The entry wound above her right eye like an erupted raspberry. "Last I heard, Shakira was doing better," he said hopelessly. "Taking one of those mothering classes from the Children's Initiative."
"Yeah, well," Stacy took a breath. "Not no more."
Billy just stared at her.
"This is why I screen your calls. This is why I..."
"What happened?" At the end of Stacy's tale, Billy was staring at his ashy coffee, his jaw askew with fury. "I need you to find someone for me," he said.
"I thought you would," Stacy sliding a single sheet of paper across the table. "Got the horse right here."
Billy speed-scanned the document and learned that Curtis Taft was still working for the same security outfit that had employed him at the time of the triple homicide, and was now living in Co-op City in the Bronx. Although the place to find him this week was neither work nor home, but at Columbia Presbyterian, where he was recovering from surgery on a perforated ulcer.
"I thank you for this," holding up the sheet.
Stacy shrugged and then looked away. Billy, sensing the mortification that still coursed through her veins over the long-ago debacle that had ended her career. "Seriously," Billy said. his own mortification equal to hers, given that she'd been right about him all along. When he had fired the shot that killed a man and then entered the groin of the 10-year-old boy who had been standing behind him, he was coked to the gills. All the WGs were that night, a fact they would keep to themselves until the day they died.
"So, Mr. Taft, how are we feeling today?" Billy's voice burbling with rage-induced pep as he whipped back the curtain that curved around the hospital bed. The sight of his white made Billy tingle with a rush of dazed energy, made his eyes brim with light.
"Oh, you again," Curtis Taft moaned, rolling his fleshy head away.
Billy couldn't believe it. The guy had nearly doubled in size since the murders, his torso so inflated that his arms looked like flippers. Taft attempted to reach across himself in order to press his call button, but Billy grabbed his wrist. "Perforated ulcer, huh? Goddamn, from what I hear, you can get that from smoking, but you smoking? Shit, you don't even eat off plastic, as far as I remember, right? Everything had to be in stone bowls, incense all over the place, a real my body is my temple type individual. So my theory is," poking the soft mound of dressing across Taft's belly, "this right here, I think it's just Tanya and those kids in there getting to work on you."
"I don't know what you're talking about, Greaves. Get the fuck out of here."
He reached for the call button again, Billy this time yanking it out of the wall.
"What's going on over there?"
the old guy on the other side of the curtain called out. Billy stepped over and raised the volume on his ceiling-suspended TV. "So," flopping down on the side of Taft's bed, "you hear what happened to Memory Williams' twin sister, Shakira?"
"Who's Memory?"
Taft said, then barking to his roommate,
"Yo, call the nurse station!"
"Oh, come on, you got to remember Shakira, real wallflower type. Well, that wallflower just killed a 16-year-old girl last week, stabbed her through the lungs with a bread knife over in Jersey City. Can you believe that? She's in Hudson County, CC right now, but she'll wind up in Clinton Correctional Institute for child-eating psycho bitches. That is, if they aren't full up, in which case they'll put her in Bellhaven, that temporary women's wing they got out there in Sparta. But the ACLU is trying to get that shut down because of the rapes. We'll see."
"I don't know no Shakira nobody."
Then attempting to sit up, barking,
"I told you call a fucking nurse!"
Billy shoved him back down, Taft grimacing through his close-cropped beard.
"Now, Memory was a handful, no doubt, fighting in the cafeteria, cutting school, running away from home, always with a boy, but Shakira, she was no trouble to anybody, 14 years old, and never been kissed, had all the answers in class, but too shy to raise her hand. But soon as you killed her sister, I didn't kill nobody and you know it, as soon as you killed her sister, all of a sudden she starts banging with the black Barbies, gets caught with a razor in her mouth going through the metal detectors, threw a chair at a teacher, they finally sent her to a social worker, the lady says to her, 'Kira, what happened to you?' You know what she said back? 'Well, somebody's got to be my sister.'"
"Graves, you just pissed off because you ain't police enough to catch a fucking cold. Cops like you, you just grab the first nigga you see and hope for the best. Well, it didn't work out so well, did it?"
"Anyways, Curtis, that was 5 years ago, and now the kid's a 19-year-old murderer with two babies of her own, and she is as fuck gets. It would probably have been better if she was in the apartment that morning and you put a bullet in her head, too. Because this is going to be one slow-motion death she's facing in there. So as far as I'm concerned, they are all in there."
Poking his sutured gut again.
"All those angry females chewing you up from the inside out. And when they finally cut you open to see what killed your ass, you know what they're going to find? Teeth marks, motherfucker. Nothing but teeth marks."
"You stop that bullshit right now,"
Taft said more quietly, his eyes going a little bit wide.
"Tell me you don't feel them," Billy pressed. "Look at me and tell me you don't feel them."
Gingerly touching his gut as if something might pop out, he looked at Billy full on. No resistance. After all these years, no resistance. Billy's heart slamming as he scrambled to seize the moment.
"You were raised in the church, right? I remember interviewing your sister. She said you all were."
"So?"
Taft said carefully. "So you believe in God?"
"Who don't believe in God?
Know your Bible?"
"Some," Taft said, still palming himself.
"Remember your Luke? Jesus coming on a man had so many demons inside of him that when he asked for his name, you remember what the man answered?" Legion, Taft said, his eyes unblinking. Legion, that's right. Legion, a whole fucking battalion, and that's what you're dealing with, too.
Taft removed his hand from his belly, placed it flat on the bed, then went still.
Now, you know and I know that's the only way to get those angry bitches out of you before they can finish what they started is for you to make a clean breast of it and say what happened that day. Say it right now. Say it to me, and they will be gone before you know it.
Taft kept staring at him, his mouth slowly going as round as a donut. Just staring and staring until he apparently saw what he wanted to see in Billy's eyes. That small quivering.
Graves. His voice abruptly all the way back.
I got a better chance of cleaning you out in court for harassment than you got of giving me a motherfucking parking ticket. Where's the goddamn nurse?
Billy yanked the pillow from under Taft's head and held it an inch from his face.
You know how easy it would be to punch your ticket right now. But they know you're here, he said,
shoving the pillow away with surprising strength for a man fresh out of surgery.
So what are you gonna do, huh? This a public building, you gonna kill me? Kill that man in the other bed, too? What are you gonna do? Fuck you.
Hi there, everything okay?
The nurse in the doorway sounded cheerful, but in charge.
Nah, he's just upset over me being like this, Taft said.
You'll be fine, she said, no one's fool. Are you just about done in here, sir? I think your friend
needs his rest, Billy finished for her. Then leaning over Taft as if to say goodbye, whispered,
You will never get rid of me,
and walked out of the room. Unable to leave the hospital, Billy paced the main hall atrium, now and then charging halfway back to Taft's room, then reining himself in until a security guard finally approached him to see what was up. Flashing his ID, Billy muttered something about a sick cop, the square badge at first backing off leery, then quickly losing interest. And then Billy saw her, Taft's wife, tall and gracefully obese, pushing a 2-year-old in a stroller across the sun-dappled floor. He reflexively moved to her, then blocked her way. Hey, Patricia, right? She stopped and stared, not able to place him. Bill Graves, I was at your wedding. She reared back, got taller, gave him a face like a fortress.
I remember you.
As well she should. When he had heard that Taft, less than a year after the murders, was getting married, Billy and Whelan, who was about to retire in any event, put on suits and crashed the wedding. Right after the minister asked if anyone objected, Billy sang out,
Right over here, because that bastard is a baby-killing triple murderer. He did it once, he'll do it again.
They got their asses good and kicked that day. Half the wedding party, both male and female, were correction officers related by blood to Taft. But it was worth it just to ruin the ceremony, or maybe not, given that the incident led to his being transferred to Night Watch, his second banishment to the underworld, most bosses believing that working any kind of steny midnights was just this side of a firing squad. So, Billy said amiably, I just want to know, how's it working out for you two? Everybody happy?
You have no right to be accosting me.
Her voice as stiff as her posture. I just want to ask you, does he ever wake up in the middle of the night all covered in sweat and screaming his head off? You know what I'm talking about, right? She waved to the same security guard across the floor, but Billy re-tinned him without even looking in his direction, the man once again backstepping to his post. Billy felt light as a feather, out of his mind, spontaneous. How's he as a dad? Nodding to the stroller, kid number 3 from what he'd heard. A real disciplinarian, I'll bet. She attempted to walk away, but Billy, astonishing himself, blocked her escape.
One last bed question. Does he ever get up, say about 6 a.m, come back about an hour later, a little winded, maybe a little bloody? I'm just curious. I work for Christian Outreach, her voice suddenly a hoarse, teary mess. I help people, and you have no right to talk to me like this.
No, he didn't. Suddenly red-faced, Billy turned from her without another word and walked away. Finally striding across the central atrium toward the exit, Billy was startled to see Pavlicek coming in through the revolving doors, moving like a sleepwalker, his eyes off-center and shining as he made his way through the slanting beams of captured sunlight to the elevator banks. John!
Hey,
Pavlicek said flatly, turning to Billy as if they had just seen each other an hour ago.
What are you doing here?
Billy's voice still burbling with adrenaline.
My doctor's here.
You okay?
Yeah, just some tests.
Tests for what?
Cholesterol's through the roof.
Yeah? What's he got you on, Lipitor, Crestor?
Vitorin.
Jimmy Daly takes that. He says it's a lifesaver.
Tell me about it.
You're not here to see Curtis Taft by any chance, Billy asked, his voice sly dog low.
Curtis Taft works here?
Pavlicek blinked. Billy took a moment, then... He's a patient. I just about put my hands around his throat.
Still fucking with him, huh?
Pavlicek sounded elsewhere, his eyes over Billy's shoulder as if there was bigger game to be had. You all right?
I just told you.
I mean otherwise.
It's a funny day. I'm late for a meeting.
A meeting here? Billy not sure whether he was still too jacked to keep track of the conversation or it was just careening off point on its own. The elevator arrived, Pavlicek silently giving him his back as he stepped inside.
Hey, what's your doctor's name?
What for?
Pavlicek towering over everyone else in the car. Billy tapped his own heart. You're not the only one.
Go to someone up by you,
Pavlicek said as the door began to close.
My guy's not all that.
The 16-year-old Yemeni kid lay flat on his back, arms flung wide, staring up with his one unexploded eye at a cardboard placard taped to the ceiling. Screw the dog, beware of owner. Above the words was a caricature of a stubble-jawed bruiser aiming a hand cannon at the viewer, the circumference of the muzzle almost as big around as the guy's head. The real shooter, who had accidentally killed his best friend while showing off his father's gun, which had been hidden beneath the cash register, was on the floor, too, sitting at the end of a food aisle. Glazed-faced and weeping, he was being interviewed by Alice Stupak, squatting on her hams as she attempted to gently tweeze out his version of events. As Billy stood by the front window debriefing the first uniform on the scene, Jean Feely came into the store with a young man, not a cop, the kid involuntarily inhaling when he first saw the body.
Back in the day, the homicide rate around here was so high, Jackie, that the precinct had to split into two just to keep pace with the bodies, Feely explained. But those days are dead and gone, so they say, although I would no sooner walk down the street unarmed around here than I would if I was living in Iraq.
What's going on, Gene? As far as Billy knew, Feely had the night off.
My sister's kid. He's doing a paper for his journalism class. I thought I'd help out.
No kidding, Billy said. Thinking the guy never shows up when he's supposed to, now he starts showing up when he isn't.
Uncle Gene, the kid said, taking in the gun cartoon directly over the body. Look at that.
Go on over there,
Feely said, taking his nephew's iPad. I'll take your picture, you can tweet it on Facebook.
Maybe you should wait until they finish, Billy said.
No problem, Billy, one of the CSUs said, raising up from the body and taking the iPad from Feely. Go ahead, Gene, get in with the kid.
A moment later, the store owner, the hem of his pajama bottoms peeking out from beneath his trouser cuffs, finally stumbled into the store, his gun permit held out before him like a magic charm, avoiding looking at either the dead kid or his son. He walked right past Billy to Feely, the most senior-looking cop on the set.
Talk to her,
Feely said, chucking a thumb at Stupak, who was coming back up to the front.
Talk to me? What's wrong with you? She snapped. Your hearing aid on the fritz?
Watch your mouth, Feely said, heading for the door.
Where are you going?
She squawked, her arms outstretched in mock bewilderment.
I gotta be somewhere. Somewhere where? She blew. You're here. Here's where you gotta be. So how about you stun the shit out of everybody and do your fucking job for a change?
Alice, Billy pulling her back.
You better talk to her, Feely said to Billy.
Talk to me?
The front door shut with a jingle.
Alice, talk to me?
Take it easy, he's off tonight.
Oh, yeah?
she said, grabbing the store owner by the arm and steering him off to a neutral corner.
How can you tell?
Milton Ramos.
He sat in his den. He had a den now, damp smelling in a way he couldn't eradicate, but a den nonetheless. He didn't even know what a den was when he was a kid. And not just a den. He had a house, a goddamn house, was the unencumbered owner of a two-story, three-bedroom mock Tudor. Of course, the neighborhood was so shitty that he had to enclose the entire exterior in decorative iron security grills, which made it look like a birdcage for a pterodactyl. But it was his, earned and paid for. And he had Sophia, sitting next to him now, watching, for the second evening in a row, Pocahontas. He must have seen that thing 75 times, Snow White, Little Mermaid, Sleeping Beauty, Mulan, and all the others at least as many times as that. But he never grew bored, because what he was really doing was watching her watch the movie. She was built like him, like her late mother, and she came in for her share of schoolyard torture. When he had been the porker back then, the teasing had quickly ended after the ringleader lost two of his brand new front teeth to a crosspipe on the monkey bars. But she was a girl, and he had no idea how girls were supposed to deal with that kind of cruelty. And so he let her watch slim, pretty young females being rescued from their tormentors by handsome boys, night after night after night. A real father of the year. Big, fast, and devoid of mercy. Ever since he was a kid, that had been the rap on him. Everyone outside his family had always been afraid of him, in school, then later on the street, then later on the job, even though he had never provoked a fight in his life. Devoid of mercy, devoid of humor, devoid of personality. But he loved deep, if not demonstrably. His mother, his two brothers, and his wife, all gone now, and this kid right here who, fortunately, he guessed, had been an infant when her mother passed. "Give me a sip," she said, nodding to the glass of yellow chartreuse in his hand. "Cut it out." "I want some,"
she wheedled in a high, teasing voice, the same ritual every night. "It's medicine, I told you that."
"I'm sick,"
dropping her forehead to his arm.
"Please."
He dipped a finger in the glass and touched it to her tongue. "It's bedtime, go upstairs."
"Carry me?"
"I can't, my back hurts," he said, wincing.
"Maybe you had too much medicine."
Milton winced again, this time for real. "Go ahead. Marilise is waiting. I'll come up later." Moving like creeping Jesus, Sophia reluctantly headed for the stairs, placing one foot, then the other on each riser, groaning like an old lady before stepping up to the next. One foot, then the other, her nightly protest march. "Go ahead now." Milton switched to ESPN, then reached for the lined sheet of yellow paper on the coffee table, so obsessively handled today that it was starting to blacken along the folds. He left it unopened in his lap. He tried to concentrate on the last 5 minutes of the Nets Thunder game, but his thoughts drifted, as they often did after a few shots, to Sophia's mother, Sylvia, 7 years earlier the victim of a hit-and-run driver on Bronx Park East, directly in front of the geriatric hospital where she had worked for a radiologist. If he had to describe their 8-year marriage in 2 words, if he was allowed to go back in time and re-script their wedding cake, he would choose, in sky blue icing, good enough. As in, good enough companions, good enough lovers, good enough parents. Good enough. As in, if God or some fortune teller had told him early on in their relationship that Sylvia was to be his mate until the end of his days, he wouldn't have complained. Except the end of her days came first. Marilise Irizarry, Milton's housekeeper and Sophia's 5-days-a-week stand-in mother, had a distinct tread, halting and striving for cat burglar light as if just leaving the bedroom of a colicky baby. But she was a short, solid, broad-foot Guatemalan, and he could always hear her on the move from anywhere in the house. She came into the den and stood directly behind where he sat on the couch.
"She's waiting for you."
"I'll be up," draining his truce without turning to look at her.
"I finished everything I could, but there's still stuff in the dryer."
"You're going home?" She leaned over his shoulder for the empty glass on the coffee table.
the Swedish tang still hanging in the air.
I could stay.
Most witnesses at the scene of the accident, the vehicular homicide, disagreed on the make and model, let alone the color of the car. One old guy was able to come up with a description of the plate, which he said was out of state, had a tree splitting the numbers against a blue-orange sunset.
Or I could go.
Visiting that half-cocked witness on the sly 2 days later, Milton asked him how he could possibly remember the tree splitting the digits against a blue-orange sunset, yet not recall any numbers or letters off the same. 3TR, left side of the tree, the old man said. It had come back to him that very morning on the toilet. Make and model? Black, maybe gray Accord or Camry. Those cars to him like two peas in a pod. The case wasn't Milton's, of course. The visit enough to get him suspended for hindering the investigation of the local squad. Although probably not really, given the mitigating circumstances, emotional duress, extreme grief, etc. Nonetheless, he kept the news of the partial plate to himself. From one flight above, the front door opened, then closed, followed by the jingle of keys in the lock. Marilise heading for home. 3 weeks after Milton's talk with the eyewitness, a middle-aged male with a suspended driver's license lay on his deathbed in Cherokee County Memorial Hospital after suffering grievous wounds in a car accident. Aaron Artest, an individual who lived in Queens but had unexpectedly returned to his hometown of Union, South Carolina about the same time as Sylvia's funeral, told investigators that an old, rust-bodied sedan with heavily tinted side windows had pulled up next to his gray Accord, plate 3TR-AM7, as he was driving alone on Highway 150. The unseen driver kept a pace for a minute or so, as if to make sure he had Artest's attention, before poking a shotgun out of the passenger window, which naturally inspired Artest to haul ass. Then his brakes, which had been serviced not even a month before, on the day he left New York, must have somehow given out.
No, he didn't fire at me, Artest said to the cops.
Then,
it looked to be a Nova. Oh, wait. Caprice? Hang on. Hold on.
Then his dying words.
Just give me a minute.
Milton clicked off the TV without registering the outcome, retrieved his glass, poured himself another chartreuse, then finally unfolded the paper in his lap, the names and addresses written there, writhing like eels. Carmen Graves, RN, St. Anne's Hospital. Detective Sergeant William Graves, Manhattan Night Watch. 684 Tuckahoe Road, Yonkers. Declan Ramon, 8. Carlos Eman, 6. Immaculate Conception Day, 24 Vanderdonk Street, Yonkers. Big, fast, and devoid of mercy. All he could say in his defense was that his older brother had been worse. From two floors above, he finally began to hear his daughter plaintively calling out for him. He had no idea how long she'd been at it, the sleepy but insistent oscillations of her voice coming down on his ears like the offbeat siren of some alien ambulance. Chapter 5. It was one of those fortuitous early mornings when Billy was able to crawl into bed a half hour before Carmen had to get up, the bakery warmth of her body coming at him as he raised the quilt, making him both alert and drowsy. Still asleep, she rolled into him, a heat-radiant breast fanning flat against his ribs, an equally hotted-up thigh carelessly flung over the front of his suddenly ridiculous boxers. But she was still lightly snoring, and with the kids about to overrun the base camp, it was better for him to concentrate on the stray curls of her hair that had managed to find their way up into his nose. It was all he could do not to sneeze.
"So you're calmed down about Taft now?" she asked him 30 minutes later.
"Yeah, but I think I want to do this thing," Billy watching her from the bed as she slipped into her whites.
"You should,"
turning away from him to brush her hair. He could hear both boys flying out of their bedroom as if someone had shouted, "Incoming!" "But why should I?" She took a breath.
"Because you want to. Because it would make you feel better. Because it's good karma," It's not like we're rolling in dough. Well, applying mascara now, which as far as he was concerned was like applying black paint to coal, we're not exactly on the street, either. Something containing liquid shattered in the kitchen, neither of them reacting. So you really think I should? I think you want my permission or something. I don't need your permission. I agree. So I should do it, right? Who? Billy Graves, looking for Miss Worthy. Hearing his flat Irish municipal accent from the other side of her door, and most likely assuming he was just another Hudson County homicide detective, Edna Worthy, the grandmother of Martha Timberwolf, the girl murdered by Memory Williams' twin sister, but really by Curtis Taft, if you wanted Billy's opinion, called out, "It's open!" letting him into her Jersey City apartment without so much as looking away from the TV. She apparently made ends meet as a baby farmer, three subsidized foster kids roaming her overheated living room like cats, although as old and heavy as she was, she could barely rise off the couch. "Can I sit?" Billy asked. She gestured vaguely to the left side of the room, nothing there like a chair. At first glance, Miss Worthy, a TV remote in one hand, a cell phone in the other, seemed unaffected by the catastrophic loss that had been visited on her only 2 days earlier, Billy chalking up her indifferent demeanor to a long, tragedy-packed life. It wasn't as if he hadn't witnessed this kind of non-reaction in people before. But then he noticed the carefully arranged semicircle of plastic frame photos on the Cheerios-littered coffee table in front of her, the murdered girl staring back at her grandmother from all of her ages, toddler to confirmation to junior high school cap and gown, the face consistently heavy and glum, as if she had known her fate from the day she was born. "Martha was the only blood to me left," Miss Worthy eventually said, reaching across herself to pick up a toddler who came close enough for her to grab. "Now she's gone, too." "I'm sorry about that," Billy said. "She helped me take care of these kids, and so how am I supposed to do that now?" "This ain't a hotel, but you should have seen where they was before." "I'm sorry," he said again, glancing at a card table strewn with the silver-foiled leftovers of a half-dozen condolence casseroles. "Well, they're all going back now, except maybe this one here," lifting up the kid in her lap like a kitten. "She looks like Martha a little. Maybe she can grow up to be some kind of conversation to me, but it's going to be a race between her growing up and me growing down." "I hear you. So what do you want to know I ain't already said 10 times to the other detectives?" Miss Worthy asked, palming crumbs off the girl. "Nothing, really. I just came by to offer to help you with the burial, you know, if you need it." Miss Worthy finally looked at him straight on, her cat's eye glasses catching the light. "You police or not, because if you're not, I'm calling them right now." Holding up the business card of the last sport-jacketed individual before Billy to come into her home. When Billy entered Brown's family funeral home, Redman, draped in his work apron, was displaying from the breastbone up a man in his 50s to two of his younger relations in the middle of his living room turned chapel. Not 10 feet away, Redman's son, velcroed into his activity walker, watched SpongeBob on a 54-inch flat screen, the volume insanely high, although no one seemed to be bothered by it. "That don't look like him," the male of the two said. "Did you see him when they brought him in here?" Redman asked. "I'm just saying. If you want, I could try to put him back the way he was," winking at Billy. Billy sidled up to the TV and turned down the volume. A few minutes later, unhappy but not sure what to do about it, the relations left the building without saying goodbye. "So what's up?" Redman asked, whipping the sheet off the lower half of the body, revealing a makeshift diaper fashioned from a tall kitchen Glad bag in order to capture any post-embalming leakage. "I want you to bury someone for me." "Who?" "A murder vic, 16 years old, or people don't have dime one." Redman's wife, Nola, came in with a shopping bag of clothes, brown suit, white shirt, a tie, socks, and shoes, the suit and socks still bearing their price tags from Theo's discount House of Men.
Where is she now?
Well, she lived in Jersey City.
So Essex County Morgue?
Redmond began muscling the pants up over the glad bag diaper, the effort making his face bead with sweat.
I assume.
That's out of state.
So?
That's extra.
You want my easy pass?
Redmond propped the body into a sitting position so that Nola could get its arms into the shirt, their son now rolling across the room while chewing on a takeout menu.
How much do you want to spend?
How do I know, Billy said. How much does it cost?
Depends on the casket, the wood, the lining, the vault, the service. I assume you want a minister, some kind of celebrant, pallbearers, limo, and a hearse out to the cemetery. Do you have a cemetery lined up?
Waiting on his wife to finish the buttoning.
Then there's the pickup, the body prep, burial clothes if you need them, flowers, printed programs. You want those memorial t-shirts? I have a guy for that. Then there's the grave marker, the plot, the opening, the closing, the death certificate.
Just help me out here, okay? Redmond wrestled the shirt tails into the pants, lifting the body off the gurney with one hand in order to do it, then stepped away to mop his brow while his wife threaded and then knotted the tie.
Who's this kid to you? He asked.
Collateral damage from Curtis Taft. It's a long story. Redmond looked at his wife for a nonverbal business discussion, which ended when she abruptly took off to corral her son as he threatened to topple the cosmetics cart, a rolling jungle of wigs, makeup jars, brushes, palette knives, and cotton swabs.
I can put something together for 7K, he finally said.
Seven? Are you high?
You want to take your business up the street? There's four parlors in the next two blocks. Anyone offers you under that, they're going to put her in a cereal box, take her out to the cemetery on the bus. I don't have 7K.
I'll ask you again, who is she to you? While Redmond and Nola began dealing with the dead man's socks and shoes, Billy told them the whole story, from the death of Shakira Barker's twin sister 5 years earlier, through her long, slow, nightmare transformation into a murderer herself, the victim, Martha Timberwolf, lying on a slab across the Hudson, with no one to send her home.
I'll do it for six, Redmond said, and that's costing me.
Nola stiffened a little, but said nothing.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Can you pay up front?
No problem.
Can you do cash?
Redmond rolling his prep cart close and pulling a chair up to the body. If that's how you want it.
Because that would help me.
Help me help you, Billy said, watching as Redmond slipped on a pair of rubber gloves, then reached into the chaos of the cosmetics cart and extracted a tube of crazy glue. After squeezing out thin lines of the gunk on the lacerated palms of the dead man, he used his finger to carefully coat the skin.
What are you doing? Billy asked.
What, this? If I don't put some kind of adhesive on these defensive wounds here and people start stroking this guy's hands at the service, they could walk away with a souvenir.
Billy took a moment, then shifted gears. You see Pavlicek recently?
He came in here a few weeks ago to see how my son was doing.
How was he?
My son?
Pavlicek.
What do you mean?
I'm not sure. I ran into him at Columbia Press today.
Oh, yeah? What was he doing there?
He said he was seeing someone for his cholesterol.
I'm not surprised, are you?
He looked like a zombie. I swear to God, every time I see him these days, it's like he's on a different drug. Tell me that's high cholesterol.
All I know is, Redmond carefully recapping the crazy glue, men that big can't just eat whatever they want.
So this witness, so-called witness, Michael Reedy, that you interviewed, remember him? Sitting across the desk from Elvis Perez, a tall, vulture-necked detective working the Banyan homicide in Midtown South, Billy tried to recall the face of the blood or ketchup-stained drunk in the Penn Station waiting room.
Sort of, he said.
Well, we lost him.
Lost him?
We have his address from your fives, but he's not there, and he's not answering his cell. So I was wondering if you remember anything he might have said to you, or you overheard, that maybe didn't make it into your notes. Do you know how many people we interviewed that night? Perez tossed a pencil on his desk and stifled a yawn. He had the kind of droopy eyes that suggested he had never recovered from the exhausting experience of being born. So where are you at on this? Billy asked.
Nowhere, really.
Billy gestured to the manila folder on Perez's desk next to a small plaster statue of San Lazaro.
May I?
Even in the bloodiest CSU photos, Banyan retained his startling black Irish handsomeness, the best-looking corpse Billy had seen since Carmen's first husband.
The ME said the wound was jagged, Perez said, rolling his chair away from the desk and then running the flat of his hand along the inside of his thigh. The actor was no surgeon, but he knew where to cut.
And nothing on the perp?
Plenty. He was short, tall, black, white, heavy, slim, came flying in on a skateboard, rolled away in a wheelchair. Are you kidding me? The guy could have been 7 feet tall with a turban, a beard, and an AK screaming death to America, and everybody there would have chalked it up to the DTs.
How about the tapes?
We finally got the South Plaza footage back, but all it shows is Banyan running to the subways after the fact. The tape we really need, from over by the LIRR information board, we're still waiting on. Taru says it could take a few days, a few weeks, or never. All that state-of-the-art equipment and some asshole spills a cup of coffee. How's that for bang versus whimper?
For what?
Forget it. You want to see what we got?
Perez slid the disc into his desk monitor, Billy standing behind him, ignoring the buzzing of his cell. The captured stretch of arcade between the Long Island commuter trains and the subway entrance at first appeared deserted, all the action having taken place out of the camera's range, the grainy footage of nothing and no one evoking the bleariness of the hour. But then here came Banyan, running loopily into the picture, his light blue jeans turning purple with blood, his dripping shoes leaving those dark liquid footprints until he came to a baffled stop in front of the turnstiles and started fishing through his wallet for what? His Metro card? Fishing and fumbling, and then, just as Billy had speculated at the scene, abruptly attempting to hurdle the low barrier, but suddenly locking up in midair as if flash frozen and dropping directly on top of the turnstile before falling to the ground.
It's not like it's without entertainment value, Perez said, but it all happened on the other end.
And how long for that tape again?
Perez shrugged.
Night watch was strictly one and done. Set up the morning man and move on to the next post-midnight felony. There were simply too many runs in a night, a week, a month, to keep tabs, or even remain curious about past crimes and still have the wherewithal to focus on the next one coming down the pike. Night watch jobs, an old boss once told Billy, were like individual tears in a crying jag. Still,
do me a favor, Billy asked. Can you let me know when it comes in?
That night he was saddled with another strange player doing a night watch one-off, Stanley Treister, from the DNA liaison unit, and when Billy entered the Metropolitan Hospital's trauma ER to oversee a run-of-the-mill stabbing, he found him sitting on the edge of a gurney staring intently at a damp-eyed elderly man under a blanket. The old guy, oblivious to Treister's presence, stared off into the middle distance as if into the void.
I messed up. The patient said to no one.
Who's this?
I thought I knew him from when I was a kid, Treister said,
his eyes never leaving the other man's face.
Do you?
No.
I messed up, the man said again.
Does he have anything to do with the run?
No.
Then?
Billy about to tell him to get in the game, then thought better of it.
And I'm going to hell.
I'll sell you my ticket, Billy said, before walking off to find the crime.
The actual investigation into the stabbing took about 5 minutes, the Samaritan who had brought the victim to the hospital confessing the moment Mayo flashed his ID, the story behind the story being two brothers, a fifth of Herradura, dominoes, and a knife. Stacy Taylor's call came through while the doer was being cuffed. Billy, grateful that it wasn't the wheel with another run, answered right away.
It's 4 in the morning, you know that, right?
I'm sorry, did I wake you? She said.
What's up?
Nothing.
I just wanted to see how it went today with Taft.
I messed up. Just went in there with no game plan and messed up.
Yeah, well, you're only human.
But I want to thank you for your help.
Hey, that's how we do.
Still on the phone, Billy momentarily went south, thinking about the last few days. Banyan, Taft, Miss Worthy, but mostly John Pavlicek, wandering into Columbia Press like someone had hit him on the back of the head with a bag of nickels.
Hello, she said.
Hey, sorry. Billy coming all the way back. Then, let me just ask, how good are you with hospital records?
Which hospital?
Columbia Press.
I know a guy there.
Yeah, who?
Then you'd know him, too.
I need you to look up an outpatient for me.
Who?
He hesitated. John Pavlicek.
Your guy from the Geese? What's wrong with him?
That's what I'd like to know.
Do you know who he sees there?
Somebody for his cholesterol, or so he says. He heard her light up, then expel that first buzzy lungful.
All right.
What do you charge for something like this?
When have I ever taken your money?
Billy's guilt made him wince. Maybe you should start. 30 minutes later, as he was leaving the hospital, his cell rang again. Yasmin on the downside of a wee hours drunk, her voice like wet flannel.
I'm just calling you to say I'm really sorry.
About?
The other night, I got so drunk, you know, I didn't even know you drove me home until Dennis told me in the morning.
Oh, come on, how many times?
Denny's a good guy, you know, he really is.
Well, being he's your husband and all. The silence on the other end reeked of wrong answer. Anyways, it's 4:30 in the morning, don't you think you should...
You want to hear something? She cut in. Raymond Delpino's older sister just had her second kid. You know what she called her? Yasmin Rose. She told me it's because I was the only one who never gave up trying to get Eric Cortez.
Well, good for her, Billy said, fishing for his car keys. And good for you.
Good for me, she slurred. I'm telling you, that baby is cursed.
Milton Ramos. 2130 Longfellow Avenue, a six-story walk-up in the still semi-shitty East Bronx, was over 100 years old, but it had been built by fresh-off-the-boat artisans. And despite the fact that by the time Milton came to be born here it was a dump, its gappy mosaic tile floor like a piss-bum's smile, its walls festooned with wilting poker chips of plaster, and its glassed-in apartment directory listing long-dead Jewish and Puerto Rican tenants like a roll call of ghosts, it still had its touches of old-world flair. But now, as he stood in the vestibule more than 20 years after he had fled for the safety of his Aunt Pauline's apartment in Brooklyn, he was shocked by what had become of his earliest home on Earth. Gutted and rehabbed in the cheapest possible way, the old crowned lath and plaster brown coat walls replaced by featureless plywood, the multicolored stone floors by prefab squares of ceramic, the ancient sway-backed marble risers by painted pine, and the amber-glassed hallway sconces by overhead halos of sputtering fluorescence.
It stinks in here, Sophia said, standing alongside him beneath the dented aluminum mailboxes.
Don't say stinks. Say smells, he said.
Then gesturing to the stairs with the head of his 34-inch Rawlings Pro Maple, because you never knew. Beauty before age. A baseball bat is a versatile thing. As Milton learned while still a teenager, a moderate swing across the shins will get a piece of shit dope slinger to share with you his strategy for keeping financially afloat, which basically comes down to stiffing Peter in order to pay Paul, then stiffing Paul and finding new suppliers. Another rap will get the slinger to tell you who the most recent Peter is, who the most recent Paul. And if, a day later, you bring the butt of the bat down reasonably hard on the splayed knuckles of either Peter or Paul, both of whom wanted to kill that little ripoff artist, you will find out the names of the hitters who were sent out to consummate the deed.
Now, once you get the actual hitters in an unoccupied apartment, bound hand and foot with gaffer's tape, you won't put another piece of tape across their mouths until they try to talk their way out of dying by telling you everything, including the truth. You can just go ahead and play home run derby until the walls, the ceiling, and your clothes are streaked with red. Sophia had a hard time climbing. "I like to go as high as I can," she had once explained to him, "because then all I have left is to go down." And by the third floor, she was struggling. But he was as patient with her as he had been when climbing these same steps all through childhood with his morbidly obese mother, her trudge mantra back then, "What a world, Milton, what a world," thrilling him with terror. 4B, Sophia announced. "Who lived here?" "Mrs. Sanchez. She was a very nice lady." "She was nice?" "Yes." 4C, who lived here?" "The Kleins." "Were they nice?" "They were old." The apartment doors, once oak, were now all single slabs of siege mentality sheet metal. Their numbers, in his time, screwed in brass, nothing more than hardware store decals. But he couldn't care less about these particular outrages against memory, because in the end, the information they provided was the same information as 20 years ago. In any way you cut it, the doors and their numbers would always tell the same story. 4D, who lived here? If he let her, she would announce every apartment in the building. But in a way, that was what they were here for, Milton taking his daughter on this Stations of the Cross pilgrimage as an inoculation against the worst parts of himself, as a living, breathing reminder of what he had to lose if he allowed himself, at this moment in time, to follow his nature. 4D, who? The Carters. Were they nice? They were okay. They had a son who was retarded. What's retarded? Not right in the head. What? Stupid, but not his fault. Sophia rolled that around for a bit, then, what was his name? Michael. Did the kids make fun of him? Some. Did you? No. How about Uncle Edgar? No. How about Uncle Rudy? He could be kind of mean, but he was a kid. Did you and Uncle Edgar get mad at him when he did that? He was just a kid. Did Grandma Rose get mad at him? She didn't get mad at anybody. Were there other retarded kids in the building? No, but one boy was gay. He kissed other boys? I guess. What was his name? Victor. Did the kids make fun of him? Oh, yeah. Did you? No. Actually, one time, when some older guys were pushing him around outside on the street, I made sure they never did that again. How did you do that? Don't worry about it. 4E, who lived here? Some girl, Inez. I can't remember her last name. Was she nice? I guess. Did you like her? I didn't hate her. Did you want to marry her? No. 4F, who lived here? Guess. You. And Grandma Rose and Edgar and Rudy. Can we go inside? There's other people in there now. No matter how many families had lived behind that door since the Ramos family ceased to be, no matter how often the rooms and walls had been torn up and rebuilt in the name of affordable housing, 4F would always be haunted, and he could easily imagine some of those that moved in here afterward waking up and weeping in the middle of the night for no reason they could understand. Little man's death, if you wanted to look at it that way, was nothing more than a gruesome case of mistaken identity. The targeted dealer, as anyone in the building could have told the men sent to lay him out, lived in 5C. So why? Milton just had to ask his killers that day in the empty apartment. Did you go to 4F? That's when they talked about the sulky girl on the stoop. Misinformation. Describe her, Edgar said, and they did.